Welcome to Discover Joyous Love with Anita DeFrancesco as your host. This is a hybrid of topics under the subjects of mindfulness, sexuality, and relationships. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Discover Joyous Love. I'm your host, Anita DeFrancesco. And today, our topic, we are going to be talking about advance toward pleasure and mental health. And I have Bond Wright with us today. She has been on the show before, and this is part two. And this is an educational teach-in about the human psychological process. And my guest is Bond Wright, and she has been with us a few weeks ago. So you can check out that YouTube video for some other information. And today we're going to get more into talking about the healing process of Reiki and therapy, the treatment cases, and how advancing toward pleasure and mental health go together. Let me give you some background first on Bond Wright. She is a fourth generation Reikian therapist, and this means she was trained by two generations away from the first Reikian therapist, Dr. Wilhelm Reich himself, and he was the creator of Reikian ergonomy therapy. And Bond was trained at California Family Study Center Reikian Training Program for professionals in Burbank, California. She was also trained by Dr. Henry Hill, an ergonomist. Dr. Hill was trained by Ellsworth Baker, and Dr. Baker was trained by Dr. Reich. So she has a very pioneering background with Dr. Reich himself way back. Of course, he's no longer on the planet, but she has carried on his work as a pioneer. So she is a pioneer of the work of Reikian ergonomy therapy. She was academically educated in California, supporting her studies with Dr. Wilhelm Reich with an academic education. She's a trainer and has trained therapists in Los Angeles, Amsterdam, Denmark, San Francisco, and London, working with them and their client population, developing healing strategies. And that's what we're going to talk about today, healing. She's a member of an 18-person therapist training program at the Santa Monica Therapy Center in the 70s. And she is a university lecturer and has lectured at various universities and Human Potential Growth Center here and Europe. She's a certified transactional analysis counselor. And TA was developed by Dr. Eric Byrne in Carmel, California. Reverend Bond is an ordained minister with the Association for the Integration of the Whole Person, AIWP, and she teaches cross-cultural anthropological spirituality. Now, the primary scope of her work includes, and I'll go through that and we'll bring her on in just a moment, opening deep, powerful emotions and the somatic life of the body, life management, existential disenchantment, depression and loss, self-realization and identity crisis, addiction and substance abuse, marriage, relationship, and conflict resolution, human sexuality, trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, otherwise known as PTSD, and the creative process as it relates to acting, music, art, writing, etc. So please help me in welcoming Bond Wright, the expert on Reikian ergonomy therapy, today, the second time on my show, Discover Joyous Love, and this is part two. Welcome, Bond. Hi.
Hello. Good to see you. Hello, everybody out there. Thank you for being with us today.
Yes. So how's things going? What do you want to, what's on your mind to start?
Well, your the title I chose here for these episodes with you is advanced toward pleasure. So there's a woman named Patricia Garfield, who's an anthropologist, and she goes all over the world, and her expertise is focused on the dream life. And so in Malaysia, the Senoi Indians, she went there and she studied that culture. And that culture has basically really a dream culture. What they do is, in the morning, everyone gathers in the village. And then the adults will ask the children, did you dream last night? So the children will talk about what they dreamt and if they dreamt at all. And if the child encounters an enemy in their dream, the adults will say, call your dream friends and ask them to help you fight this enemy. Or the adults will say something like, well, did you have sexual intercourse? with anyone in your dream. Of course, this is quite extraordinary for us. We don't talk about dreams in the first place in our culture, and we certainly hardly ever ask our children anything like, did you have intercourse, you know? So, however, these are pre-technological cultures. They're indigenous. And the child might say, well, no, I didn't do that. So then the parents will say, well, if that happens again tonight, make love with that person. So you see how extraordinarily different that is to what we would do here. And so the next morning, the child will say, oh, yes, well, you know, I had some dream friends came and one of them I made love with. And then the parents will say, well, did you have an orgasm? And the child will say, no, I didn't know to do that. Should I do that? And then the parent will
say, or do they know how, what
exactly.
It is?
Right, exactly. So then the parent will give them some instruction and sort of send them out into the dream world again at night. And when they come back the next morning, the parents will say, well, did you make love? And did you advance toward pleasure? We want you to advance toward pleasure because we believe that advancing toward pleasure is the human being's natural state, that we are naturally created to experience pleasure, to pursue pleasure. And in every hour of every week, of every day, that this should be our attempt here on the earth in some form. So it's not always about sex, but it is, I'll talk about it, it's about a lot of other things that have to do with pleasure. So the child will come back the next day and say, oh yes, you know, I learned how to advance toward pleasure and I had an orgasm. And then the village will applaud and everybody's happy and turn to the children who didn't know how to do that and instruct them. So isn't this incredible? Isn't this absolutely amazing? So, and we talk about Wilhelm Reich and his whole perception of what is fascism and how does it occur? So we have this darling, sweet little baby that's born. Every baby that's born is hope for humanity. And about 17, 18 years later, that little baby turns into a goose-stepping soldier. What happened? So people like me, so like Wilhelm Reich and many people, anthropologists like Margaret Mead, progressives, psychiatrists like Gabor Mate, the Hungarian psychiatrist who talks a lot about the socio-political milieu zeitgeist in which creates mental illness. How does it happen? So many people look at this very carefully, and Reich did too. He talked a lot about how fascism was created, and he talked about also how to uncreate it. And then there were a group of people at the Esalen Institute, which is the psychological satellite in Esalen, in the 70s, who were also looking at this, and they created something called the Rights of Children. So it's a 10-point program on the civil rights of children. And so Reich and they and me and others, we say that unless child rearing practices are different than what they have been, that you will always create a mentally ill population. And even worse than that, some of them will become sociopathic. So what is a sociopath? A sociopath is someone who has no compassion for the pain of others. They are completely disconnected from their core, from their center. And the more disconnected you are, the more insane you are. The more disconnected you are from yourself, from the real you, from your natural processes as a human being, this creates all the different psychiatric disorders, like obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety, depression. And what Reichian therapy does, as Reich created it, and process, is how to change that, how to take individuals who have become disconnected from themselves for some reason. Oftentimes it's child rearing practices. Oftentimes it's a general overall existential disenchantment going on in the culture in general that does not give the child what she or he needs to continue to be connected to themselves and therefore avoid any mental disorders. So pleasure and mental health and mental disorders are completely connected. If we look at dolphins are like very joyous when we're not bothering with their water, you know, putting poisons in there. They're out there enjoying themselves and they're jumping, you know, in the sea and they're happy as pie, you know. Well, they have something called the autonomic, they don't have an autonomic nervous system. We do. And if you hit a dolphin over the head, it'll go unconscious and probably die. If you hit us over the head, we'll go unconscious, but we won't die. The autonomic nervous system continues, moving our heart, moving our lungs, moving everything that needs to happen. So we are different from they are. So the autonomic nervous system is of quite a lot of interest to us as Reichian therapists, and how that is connected to mental health, how that's connected to the development of the human being. So just a little briefly about Wilhelm Reich himself. He was born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. By the time he was 12, he lost his mother, and shortly after there, he lost his father. And then right after that, he lost his country. So
how did he come to the United States? How did it get over here? So you can get into that a little bit, how it came to this part of the world.
Okay. So Reich, he became a soldier and he fought in the war over there. And then by the time he wasn't even 19, 20, 21 years old, he migrated to Sigmund Freud's Polytechnic Institute Clinic in Vienna. And he trained with Freud to become a what was called then an orgonomist. Reich never called his, the way he practiced, Reichian therapy. That came later in the 70s. So along with psychoanalysis, he opened an office down from Sigmund Freud and began seeing patients. And mind you, he wasn't even 22 years old, Harley. We can't even do that in this country. So in the early stages of the development of that kind of approach, that psychoanalytic approach, nobody else was doing it. So, I mean, you could get trained with what was available. So he did that. And in those days, insanity was defined very differently. There's a huge revolution happened in this country in the 70s, the late 60s and 70s, about what is mental illness, just even defining it. And it used to be that mental illness was seen not as a condition of the socio-political conditions in a culture, like poverty, for instance, but it was seen more as a failure of the person's morality or a failure of the person's chemical mental makeup. But it was very much imbued with sin and you're bad, you're not any good. It was also very much imbued with take an individual born in the peasant classes of England. Poverty is the worst violence that there is. Hardly anyone thinks that, but it is, because it's every day of every minute of your life that you don't have what you need. And that's simply violent. It causes mental illness. So a lot of people in that culture in London became insane. I use the word insane. You can use the word insane in there somewhat too, but. And so these folks, there was even penal colonies set up to put these people in chains. And they would be raving, you know, day in and day out, possessed by the devil. They were diagnosed as that, you know. Well, if you look at it all realistically, if you're born and your parents are dirt poor and you don't have anything to eat and you're being constantly abused and exploited and on and on. You're not even going to get a chance to develop a normal human being. You're going to be a bit out of sorts, don't you think?
Absolutely, of course. And this makes the brain hallucinate. And this is, you know, children, when the brain hallucinates, you get things like ADHD, you get different diseases just from the poverty in itself, or even the poverty creates, you know, medical diseases, and that leads to deterioration of the brain, maybe somewhat.
So I'm going to ask me again about that a little bit and how we Reichians perceive that. So what happened in the, so Reich, he was practicing, and instead of suppressing his goal with his patients, suppressing their emotions and getting them to stop crying, screaming, you know, or he actually did something quite different. He encouraged them to do that. He encouraged them to open their emotions.
It's so powerful, powerful in that time. It was unheard of.
Very unheard of. He also acknowledged that human beings are sexual from the very beginning, that we are sexual naturally without being interfered with, and we will practice or participate in our sexuality with a sense of ethics and morals. That's very important to include that. So what Reich did is he encouraged his patients to do that. He noticed something, that when he encouraged them to breathe, their emotions opened even more. So these powerful, along with encouraging the autonomic nervous system and breathing, he encouraged them to discharge what was called the word discharge emotions. And something astonishing happened. They got better. They became more centered. They became more rational. They became more functional. They were then able to make decisions about their lives. Good, solid decisions. They were able to participate more as adults. So Reich himself was a very politically conscious sort of chap. You know, he looked very carefully at what causes. If you gave everyone $5,000 and put that in their bank account every month, you would be doing quite a lot for mental health. You'd be doing quite a big thing for.
Of course.
Yeah, because
the worry goes away. People can buy what they need and not go into a denial personality to character, or they can, you know, all of a sudden they can have confidence and they can start to love themselves.
That's right. And they don't have to take humiliating jobs that they can't, that really constantly tear them down. They'd have access to education, more. They become much better problem solvers. They would choose more to mediate, choose mediation techniques with their family, with their friends, their neighbors. And so you really, that one thing, you know, politicians in our country, you know, we're always fighting about this. You know, they want programs like the program Head Start, for instance, which was created in the early 70s. And it was just, the government put some money into programs all through the United States and gave kids a head start, you know, gave them lunches, gave them some tutoring before they were even 6 or 7 years old. And then sociologists studied that, and these kids were much more functional human beings, much more participatory, and they were available to participate in democracy. That's what they were able to do. So Reich, at some point, because of his politics, he sort of got in trouble with the psychoanalysts there in Vienna. They didn't like that very much. And then because he was trying to practice psychoanalysis and therapy, he got in trouble with the political parties. So he got in trouble with pretty much everybody.
But he was ahead of his time, and what he was doing was unheard of. And of course, they're going to try to dismiss him in any way that they can, because he appeared to be this genius, and he was.
Well, he certainly had that overview, and He studied children, what makes children happy and what makes them not happy. And he came, he was at the right place at the right time in a way. And because he had to flee the Nazis himself, he had to do that. There is some validity to pain instructs, you know? And so people who, there are some tribes that actually put their youth through painful rituals as a way of teaching them some wisdom. And then when they demonstrate they have some wisdom, then they're admitted into the tribe. So I learned quite a lot about human beings, not so much from psychology, but a lot from anthropology. There you study beings all over the world, like Australian Aboriginals, Indian and Malaysia. I mean, who would think of adults telling their children to advance toward pleasure in your dreams and make love with someone? I mean, that's...
Well, they were primally connected. They had that primal nature. And that's what they learned. They weren't as civilized as, say, like in the sense of the Western world. Mm. And so they had that primal way about them. But what you were saying is earlier is that they would, beat them to whatever until, and then accept them in the tribe, kind of like the tough love thing that Americans do to their children here in this day and age, that they don't show love. They just give them tough love. And I'm totally against that. But I do agree with the Aborigines when they, you know, would accept them into the tribe, in certain conditions, and they had to, you know, do things and walk the fire or whatever. And like Anthony Robbins, you know, walk the fire and then you're accepted. But I think the way these Americans now, they want to do this tough love and they just talk down to their children and they, yeah. It's not, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't work. And I'll, you can ask me about that a little bit more later and I'll explain what that's about. So finishing with Reich's, his history, he came to the United States and he established a center in Maine called Organon. And he began training orgonomists. They were called orgonomists. And so he also was very much involved and interested in scientific analysis of this energy called orgone energy. So I'll go just very briefly into
yes,
that.
What, so talk about that. What, you know, well, you can get into that, how it's the application, how it applies to healing to someone, because I'd like to talk about the healing process with,
So orgone energy, Reich called it orgone energy, and the Chinese call it qi, the Indians from India, they call it prana, Native Americans probably called it spirit. But it's this energy in the human being that if you have it, you're alive. If you don't have it, you're dead. So he said this orgone energy comes in from the stratosphere. And the Buddhists are talking about this, and they're all talking about it, not necessarily to each other. And they came up with, there is this energy called orgone energy. So in the medical profession, they don't believe in this energy. They believe bones, blood, you know, skin. They don't believe in energy, you know. However, this orgone energy, this breathing, enables the individual in treatment to allow them to open deep, powerful emotions. So Reich did quite a lot of scientific studies about that. He created some very famous, called Oranar, Oranar experiment. He did quite a lot of research on cancer. His statement was, thoroughly saturated cells with orgone energy cannot give a place for cancer. It will not support cancer cells, radical cells. Mm. So there's all kinds, you can even create your own orgone energy accumulator. I had one at my institute for quite a number of years, and then we had to move and have quite enough space for it. And you can grow plants inside the orgone energy accumulator, or grow very quickly, or you can heal wounds inside the orgone energy accumulator. So that's about Reich. And Reich was very outspoken about sexuality. He saw the connection, like the Senoi Indian, to human sexuality and mental health. He saw that that was really a connection. That's very threatening and very controversial for some people. And in any case, so we say that the more you are disconnected, the more you are, you have acquired a certain amount of power in your community, the more you are going to be threatened by anyone talking about sexuality. So, you know, Kinsey and Masters and Johnson and Sheer Height, these are all these people that did a lot of research on sexuality. Sheer Height, Masters and Johnson, Kinsey, these folks, there's even a school in San Francisco, you can train to become a sexologist, you know, that happened in the 70s also. So let's come a little fast forward. So in the late 60s and 70s, a lot of people fled Europe because the Second World War was going on. And they came over here, and some of them created Gestalt therapy, some of them created reality therapy, some of them created Wilhelm Reich was here, and so forth. So sanity, insanity were redefined. We redefined it, and we said primarily it's not genetic, it's not chemical, it's sociological. It's from the environment the individual was reared in, particularly the child, what kind of environment. And there was a lot of looking at, is the nuclear family really the best place for this? You know, maybe we should be rearing our children tribally. So anyway, sanity was redefined, and emotional discharging and going after your emotions, having emotions in the first place, was approved of as the best route to discovering yourself and learning about yourself and learning about others. So in the early 70s, there were some training organizations that appeared, you know, like the Radix Institute here in Los Angeles, which that is my line. I'm from the line of Radix Institute people. And we renamed it. I didn't personally rename it, but others, my trainers, renamed it Orgonomy to Reichian Therapy. And it was called Reichian Therapy then. I don't know that Wilhelm would approve that or not. I suspect he probably wouldn't, you know. But
yes. Wilhelm Reich. We're speaking about Wilhelm Reich. You're listening to Discover Joyous Love. And my fabulous guest is Bond Wright, located in Los Angeles. And she is one of the most successful, talented Wilhelm Reich orgonomy therapist that I have ever known on the planet. And she is a protege of, you know, you're coming from the days of Wilhelm Reich when he was around in he died just what in the 1950s, right? That wasn't that long ago when you think about it. Oh. I was born in the 50s, you know, but so he kind of, but you took on his work and carried it. So we are listening to, you're listening to Discover Joyous Love and Bond Wright. Go ahead, continue. So maybe you want to get into, you know, talking about some cases or continuing where you were.
Okay. So different people began saying, the somatic is important. So there were people like Stanislaw Grof, Alexander Lowen, Erica, people at the Radix Institute who all started, and Esalen, all said, oh, okay, somatics, body, mind are connected.
How about Periakos, core energetics? He took on Reich's work, didn't he?
Or everybody did. Everybody took their
And Lowen did too. Lowen, right. He did the bioenergetics more than anything.
Right. Yeah. So that's a very important companion to the work that I do as in Reichian therapy. So, there were, you know, 20, 30, 40 Reichian people trained in the 70s, and all these other folks, they were learning and teaching and learning. And so there was a big explosion, you know, of people, oh, the body's here and it's connected and you have to be in your body. Otherwise you can't know yourself, can't know anyone, you know? So that was a great thing that happened to humanity. That was a wonderful thing that happened to humanity and in the field of psychotherapy, psychology, psychiatry. It was a wonderful thing that happened. Not all psychologists and psychiatrists think that, though. They focus in other areas, more mental, the cognitive, and or drugs, psychiatric drugs. Mm. Okay. So my group of people, I cannot in first place legally prescribe it. And even if I could, I wouldn't want to. Don't think Prozac is the way to go to get rid of depression. We don't think that that's the way to go. So first time I ever saw Reikian therapy was, it was in a large conference, humanistic psychology conference in Goleta. And there were at least 1,000 people in the room. And the Radex people, they put out 10 mats in this big conference room. And they had their trainees standing at each mat. Some of them were already certified. And they invited the audience to have what they call the Reikian intensive. Right. So that was
powerful. Yeah. Well, just as your work is so powerful. Yeah. But
very incredible. Very incredible. So I began practicing and, you know, after my training, and I also had trained with transactional analysis counselors, who was created by Eric Byrne, and a combination as a young person, I was looking at, what's the best way to be a therapist? You know, I don't want to waste my time on anything that's not going to work. I want results. It's what I want. Okay. So, you know, when you're young, you're very idealistic and you're going to burn the world up and nobody did it before you. And, you know what you're up against yet, you know. But fortunately, I did choose two really good approaches, you know.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, so my view is you cannot always just have a Reikian therapy intensive and that solves your life. Because we live in a modern world, we have to do our taxes, we have to drive cars, we have to make decisions, we have to interact with people. So transactional analysis quickly was created by Eric Byrne, and it's a very powerful cognitive approach, and it's very underestimated right now, in my opinion. And with Reikian therapy. So that's kind of like some background. And as you mentioned in the introduction, I've been practicing this approach here and in Europe and so forth, teaching other therapists for some number of years and so forth. And so that brings us to actual. Do you have a question about cases for me or something now?
Well, yes, I'd like you to share some of your cases and the application, and then we can get into, is Reikian really for everyone? And when is it contraindicated? Because this is the kind of therapy, it's very, very, it can be scary to people that just start out, but it may not be for everyone, and it really isn't, but I know it really, it's empowering. So yeah, let's talk about some of the cases and...
I will address your question.
Is and how the mental health, the advance for pleasure and the mental health, they're so connected, and yet people don't see that the mental health and the pleasure are very connected.
Yeah, very connected, because human beings need pleasure.
Right, but pleasure, people think of pleasure as the taboo, or they make it taboo, sex. But pleasure is not sex. It's like pleasure being joyful and happy and having your senses open and being feeling good and positive about life and not walking around being depressed because it's raining or you don't have the great boyfriend or girlfriend or job or whatever. But, you know, the feeling is making love to everything. It's love. That's what it is. That's what pleasure is. And people think, when you talk about pleasure to people, they automatically go into they inhibit themselves in their body to think like, oh, sex, oh, that's bad. Oh, it's bad. You know, and like with those people you were talking about earlier, we're talking about children, they talk about advance toward pleasure. They didn't mean for them to go have sex at such a young age. What they really mean is for them to just be boundless and be liberated and free and enjoy their humanness, right? Isn't that what advancing toward pleasure is? And
yes,
and to beginning.
So there's higher states, the ability to look at a tree and feel pleasure, the ability to look at an animal or go towards animals and have relationships with animals and enjoy that interaction, the ability to be delighted by a color, you know, the color blue, the color purple, to be delighted by that, the ability to be excited about the fact that you're alive and you have a life. You know, we're alive. How amazing is it that we're alive? We won't always be here. What a shame it is for us to be alive and not celebrate that and then die.
Right.
Health is all about that. It's all about getting to the place where you can actually enjoy your own self, enjoy who you are, enjoy how you are, be delighted with your own idioms, to be delighted with respecting. And one of my past clients said, "You taught me what a human being is." And she never knew what a human being was until she went through this program.
Bob is an attorney. He is busy, successful, and leads a fulfilling family life. Medical orgone therapy has helped him deal with generalized anxiety.
Stand not talking and breathe and stay with it. Then you'll feel more instead of talking.
I wasn't anxious about any particular thing. I was just anxious, physically anxious. The mail would come and I would be scared about what was in it. The phone would ring and I'd be scared to answer it. I just was in a constant state of distress. I could still function through it. I just couldn't tolerate it any longer.
Okay. Let it come out. Grab it out. It's the repressed anger that's in him. These feelings and emotions are actually physically held within the body, in the armor.
I knew that I had had a very difficult childhood, and I knew that beneath the anxiety that I was suffering was tremendous anger. I was physically and emotionally abused by both of my parents when I was young. My household was very, very cold. I was not told once by my parents that they loved me.
He was not a bad kid. He was a regular kid. He made some mistakes as a child, broke something or lost something, but he lived in terrible fear that he would be caught and reprimanded and beaten.
You peel off the first layer and you have an understanding of what the under layers are about, but as you peel each of them off, you experience it more deeply and the memories become more intense, and so the whole experience of therapy leaves with you what you lived through. When I'm in therapy now, I actually re-experience emotionally the experiences I had then that caused my anxiety, and it was the way my parents treated me. It's really very simple. The most horrible thing I experienced in therapy in terms of memories was my mother coming in to my crib at night when I was very small and looking down at me with a very mean, hateful, angry look, when really what I needed from her was her love and her comfort. And I remember even her putting a pillow over me, over my mouth, to keep the noise down, you know, to keep the crying down. There's a certain spot where I look and I see her face, and it's very angry and mean, and she's screaming at me, and she's real close right down in my face. And then I see that, and the crying happens first, then the fear always happens next, and then the rage after that. Getting out the fear and the crying gives me a sense of relief, but getting that rage out, that bloody murder, is absolutely delicious.
We encourage the release of the emotion in whatever way that it comes out best. The patient can scream, choke, smash, to release the rage in the way that feels best for them is what works best and does the job.
You know that you're not really killing anyone, and that getting those feelings out is critical to being able to move on through the process. From my experiences here, it's just so clear to me why I have the feelings that I have, but knowing where they came from doesn't help. It relieves this sense of searching and mystery, but it doesn't help with the feelings to know it. I have to get the feelings out here on the couch in order to feel better.
He feels that he is much more able to relate with people and function better in his work. He's gotten married, he has two lovely children, and his enjoyment in life is much, much more than it ever was.
The pressure from all of the rage and the fear has been draining out of me. I've become capable of feeling my feelings. Without this therapy, I would have acted towards my children in a very similar ways that my parents would have. I wouldn't have known any different. I would have looked at them as little soldiers like I was looked at. And I think that made a tremendous difference in them. You know, they're very open, good, wonderful, loving kids that are a pure joy for me. It's the most wonderful thing. It's why I'm alive. It's for them and for my wife. And I can't get too serious about anything else that goes on.
So I'm going to talk about, you know, some of my cases. So
yes.
You're very clear, folks, on pleasure is very critical for your mental health. They are connected. And the chaotical problem is that when we're depressed, when we're sad, when we have past hurts, we have emotions from the past that never got resolved, we can't feel pleasure. Because the pleasure is an expansion, for one thing. The individual personality, the ego, the body, that's an expansion. You have to be able to expand. And depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, all these kinds of things are what we call contractions, pulling in, pulling down. So let's talk about a few people that I've worked with. I'll talk about a really amazing session that I gave at 15th and Wilshire here in Santa Monica, California. In the 80s, I think I mentioned it the first time, you know. And I'll also mention another one that, how much do we have? About like 15 minutes?
Yeah, 15, 20 minutes, yeah.
Okay, just checking in, folks. So my program, you know, primarily, there's an intake session. I look at the individual, ask them quite a lot of questions. And then after I'm clear about what needs to happen, I write a treatment strategy for them. I write in a transactional analysis treatment strategy for them. So different people, in my opinion, pretty much everybody is PTSD. I think that in the first place, that because of the sad state of affairs of our society, let's put it this way, our loss of the garden, let's put it that way. Yeah. That we have, many of us have gotten away from, been thrown out or misled or lost or not looking for where we really belong, that we all experience a certain nostalgia about maybe some place, some time in our consciousness, things were better. I don't know, Ryan Eisler, if you're familiar with her work, she wrote The Chalice and the Blade, very important work. And she talks a lot about what used to be in the Paleolithic and then what happened after that. And I agree with her, you know, and society, our world's really changed a lot. So I think with PTSD, we're very nostalgic for maybe heaven on earth, we could put it that way, where people are living happiness and abundance and there's, you know, lots to eat, and we're all sitting around being creative, we're creating concerts, we're making beautiful paintings, we're creating architecture, you know, we're doing all those things. were having interactions with other villages, singing music, dancing, you know, doing government, doing politics, you know, all really positive. I think right there we are PTSD, period, pretty much everybody right there. But in more of a psychological nomenclature analysis, if you want to use those words, I had a client who came to me. She heard me, a friend of hers, speak, and she came in, and she was quite heavy, and she was eating a 5-gallon jar of mayonnaise and a chocolate cake every day. Mm. So that's, you know, being called an eating disorder. But what's at the bottom of it? And how do we change that? It's so happened that this young woman was captured by some gang members, she and her cousin, and they were raped for 3 or 4 days. Her cousin went to a freeway overpass and jumped over and committed suicide. This particular young woman, she wasn't even 17 years old yet. She heard someone speak about me at a college, and she came to me. So is her problem, should we just give her counseling about what to eat, what not to eat? That's not going to work. There's something much more deeper going on. Like, for instance, shock, pain, trauma, humiliation, all those emotions. So over a period of time, Reikian therapy will treat all of that. And there is a program that's I diagnose and I do create a program particularly for that individual. So one thing also stands out, she wanted to become a drummer. And she really had no hope whatsoever that she could do that. And along with treating the trauma and going through what happened to her, and each session counseling her and showing her how to get to a position of power in this terrible situation. How terrible can that be? Who could possibly survive this? Well, through this treatment and through group work, she was able to do that. She also became a drummer. And then she went off in her career, her job as a percussionist. So let's talk about another individual. Here comes into my office. I mentioned it earlier. He's three-piece suited gentleman. Looks very impressive. You look at him, you really wouldn't want to get into any kind of a scuffle with him. He looked very powerful, you know. Yeah. He turns out that he is an attorney, and he complains that he procrastinates. He's a very big procrastinator. He procrastinates so much. This is very dangerous when you're an attorney, because he can't get his papers filed on time. Right. So he lives in a constant state of terror that he's not going to be able to fulfill his duties as an attorney. He also cannot quit his job. So he is caught in many different directions of really a terrifying life, all the time having to present, being competent, being, you know, someone of influence and respect and so forth. A terrible position. I have to say that all the people I've ever worked with, they're all heroes. Everyone. Everyone is a hero. If you look closely into people's lives and what they have had to go through, and they can still find it in themselves to not give up hope, to still want to be whole human beings, to seek out a therapist. Some of them seek out 4, 5, 6, or 7 therapists. Mm. And they keep going until they find what they're looking for. They do. They keep, that's amazing. That's amazing. So they're nothing. They are heroes. We should have a National Heroes Week or something for people who go into therapy. And
that this would be just another, you know, we have so many different, things like this going on, but this is something that really needs focus, I think. The mental illness, the mental illness of it all. And the average everyday person, everybody has some kind of split.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be crazy schizophrenic like my brother. He's a schizophrenic. You know, one day I touched his shoulders. I start like massaging his neck and he goes, he's so brilliant. He goes, why didn't they do this to me when I first became a schizophrenic instead of giving me medicine?
Exactly.
That's exactly what he said. And still he don't take medicine.
That is exactly what should have happened.
And they have the intervention now for these types of people and, you know, along with their meds and whatnot. But, you know, it's interesting that people don't think, I'm not talking about schizophrenics in general, but just the everyday person, like you said, if they paid more attention to this, we can have just more clearer minds out there, more, you know, more sanity, more self-esteem, more progress. And we really need to go there. That's why the world, there's a lot of, you know, the gun shooting and all, that's all mental illness.
Yes, it
is. A normal person doesn't do that.
So this particular person, we'll call him John. On the third session, we do work with people on meds. They're on meds. And he's screaming. A lot of screaming started happening. Well, it so happens that he lost his mother as a very young child. His father remarried. The second family did not want him. So one day when he was playing in the cellar, two of the men in the second family went into the cellar, put him on a swing that they had concocted. They swung him very hard so that he would swing and he'd hit the ceiling and crash his skull and or hit the ground and crash the skull there. They were trying to kill him, in other words. Want to get rid of him. It so happened that his grandmother heard him screaming. She went down into the cellar and they took him to the hospital, and that was a very traumatic experience. He learned a lot right there. He learned that he wasn't wanted. He learned that his life wasn't worth, and the trauma of that, he lived his whole life with that, and he actually did exceptionally well in some areas. You know, when he went through law school, that's amazing right there, you know. So through treatment, had to work through that trauma, and having worked through that, he then did not anywhere near what he did in the beginning, became much more functional as an attorney, became much more functional as a father and as a husband. He went on to participate in the community in ways he never could have before. He was able to move out a very constricting, very small legal firm that he was in. He had the courage then to really be able to utilize his talents, his intelligence, and moved into a larger firm where he was much more financially rewarded. It was better for his wife, his family, and so forth. So that is one individual. That's the second individual. Let's take a third individual. Came to me through a chiropractor who referred him to me, and looking at her time, and he said to me, I went to my chiropractor and she said, I can't do anything more for you. You need to go to this Reiki therapist. I can't do anything more for you. What's going on with you? You need a Reiki therapist. So he came to me and his back was like literally going out. He'd go to the chiropractor and she'd do the best she could, but it never really worked. He was always suffering. He was always extremely anxious and depressed. And turns out that he was the French hornist in a major orchestra here in the United States. And it sounds wonderful. Well paid, a lot of recognition, prestige. Comes from a long musical family and they're all delighted, you know, their only son was carrying on the tradition. There was only one problem. He didn't want to be a French artist.
Oh, so he was more or less just following the footsteps of the family, but something that he didn't really have a desire for. And there goes the pleasure, the desire and the pleasure of living your liberation, what you want to be, who you are.
Well, it was literally breaking his back. And so he really wanted to be a history teacher.
Oh.
So through therapy, they threatened to disown him. He'd bring it up. I want to leave. I don't want to be a musician anymore. His family would threaten him. He was also very worried about the financial problem that it would cause. He would no longer have that kind of money that he was used to. But somewhere, as a result of treatment, he was able to get up the courage and he took that step and he stepped out of that role. He did go back and get a master's degree in history, and he ended up teaching at a community college in San Diego. What happened to the back problems? Gone. Not there anymore. Okay.
Right.
People, what happened in the process itself is I do write one specific to the individual and what I think they need. And sometimes I bring other people in. I'll bring my medical doctor who's trained in Eastern and Western medicine to treat a client of mine who had had 3 or 4 medically unsafe abortions. She was very scarred in her ovary area and so forth. That treatment, acupuncture, and this treatment, she was able to establish a much better life and make better choices for herself to be able to take care of herself. So when you come to addictions, it's always like, not like eating disorder. What's eating? It's not what you're eating. It's what's eating you. So let me get to this existential disenchantment.
Yes, that's a good one. Yeah.
That is a diagnosis that I created, that term, existential disenchantment. In colloquial terms, because I like to break things down to where everyone can understand what I'm talking about, you know, it means you're unhappy.
Right.
You're unhappy with your life. You might be unhappy with your relationship. You might be unhappy where you live. You might be unhappy what you do. You might be unhappy everything. That's going to create anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive disorders, overindulgence in substances, all these kinds of things. So the core problem is this individual needs to get someplace where they're more existentially enchanted. So here we go, kind of like back to pleasure and magic again, aren't we? We don't have enchantment in our life, and we don't have any magic in our life. We don't have any pleasure in our life. What's the point? Human beings really need all that.
Right.
To be a human being and to be mentally healthy. We need all of that. So that's very tricky. And all the kinds of things that are presented. Maybe you just never had any trauma, but you're just not happy with your life. You know,
right.
It's another case. A person came to me, is also referred to me by another source. He was a fairly well-known rock star musician. And he came in and said, I can't do this anymore. I can't write music anymore. I hate music. I'm all dried up. I think I'm done for. I want to commit suicide. Well, that's pretty serious.
That sure is.
That's your love is to
and music is so enchanting to begin with, and that the writer, the musician, is not finding the enchantment that the audience is, because music is enchanting.
Here's a fun example, kind of a light on the light side. The actor who sang Deo, he just passed away a couple of days ago. It's not Portier, it's the other one.
He was an actor.
Yeah, he sings Deo. Remember
Deo? Deo, Deo. Oh, what was his name? They just mentioned him the other day, yesterday on the news.
2 or 3 days ago, he just passed away. Well, probably everybody listening to this, they're all probably waving their hand. Me, I can tell you, but he said he hated singing Deo. Well, I guess after you have to sing it a million times, you're going to hate Deo, you know.
Yeah,
right. Of course, he had another profession, so he could do acting, not just sing Deo all the time. But I've heard this from a lot of musicians, and I'm sick of it. You know, like dancers, I can't stand dancing because they have to do it so much all the time, you know. So,
well, you talk about the arts and the acting when you say that, you know, in your and you say the creative process as it relates to acting. I mean, acting and music and all that is a form of release for people. It's a form
exactly. Yes, it is.
And if they get stuck in there, then there's other things, you know.
Is that word stuck? Yeah. So this client of mine, the rock musician, by the way, he came in with his electric guitar, which
You still have the electric.
I found a museum, but we're not going to use that right now, you know. And so he was from another state. And I do something that's called a residential, which means you're
right. Sort of talk about your work, how people can come to see you in this way, you know.
So a residential is when you see me. It's for out-of-state people, out-of-country people, but it's also for local people who are in a crisis, a political crisis. And what it is you see me 1, 2, or 3 weeks, 1 or 2 sessions per day. And like, I pretty much guarantee you at the end of that, you will change because there is no way for you to go through something like 12 or 16 intensives and not change. You know, you will change, you know.
Yes.
The old problems probably not be there forefront. You probably will be very relieved about that, but you will also have some new problems. There might be, I can't be a French hornist anymore. So that means you got new problems now, you know. So having going through that treatment, and we'll call him John, he came in and he said, I just wrote a new song. I don't know where it came from. I never write songs like this. This is not me. This is not me. And I said, well, evidently it is you because you wrote it, you know. So he went off into the, you know, into the great beyond, and he was back on point again, writing music, performing it, and so forth. So this kind of work is very important for people who are in the arts, like acting or painting, music, dance, and so forth. It's a natural kind of thing. It also, of course, you know, of course, treats sexual problems, PTSD, and so forth. Is it for everyone? I would say no.
Yeah, it's not. So why would
these are the conditions of which not? You have to be able to have a certain amount of time and attention in the here and now. If you are so traumatized, this is not the therapy for you. Okay, you're that terribly traumatized. That is why I also use transactional analysis. It is a very gentle, effective, and powerful cognitive approach. Now, I might be utilizing transactional analysis with a client for several weeks, maybe even several months. And I might put in a little Reiki therapy session in there, you know, 1 every 5 weeks or something. So I'm easing them gently, you know, their somatic existence. So I'm doing that, you know. And so, yes, it is for everyone, but it is not for everyone going with their particular psychological arrangement immediately. And I'm just very finally on that. I remember having a client whose father used to hang her over a cliff by her thumbnails. Mm-hmm. Saying, I'm doing this to you for your own good because you're a bad girl. Mm-hmm. And she would look down like half a mile, right? Terrifying, horrible, horrible. Okay.
I'm sure she's frozen, got frozen from that in her character.
Well, she would have to be, wouldn't she, Nia?
Yes.
It's the only way to survive. And that's what goes on in the human psyche. It will freeze the person, as I like to say, to a better day that might come. And that wounded person can get some attention, can get some real human, the milk of, you know, human kindness from somebody in some kind of way. So it took... These individuals will do quite a lot of transference onto everyone. What is transference? It's when any past experience you've had that was traumatic or bad, you'll transfer it into everyone until you resolve that.
Right.
It's called transference. Yeah. So you could barely be in the same room with her. She was so terrified of everything and everybody. Amazing, amazing hero. And she would even try to go to a therapist. I mean, these people are amazingly courageous.
Yeah. And we need to have a holiday for that. The courageous people that,
yes,
that go through the work to heal, the work in progress to heal themselves and make themselves better, because
yes. One more, he's a fellow who came to me and very head gone, he had some electroshock, and unfortunately, that's a whole other topic, but I do have some opinions about it based on experience, my experience. But when he was a baby, a toddler, his parents decided he had bow legs and he should have his legs broken and put in casts. Well, that's not just like a blob of flesh sitting there. That's a human being that has feelings and thoughts and so forth. And they never asked him, son, would you like us to break your legs so that they can be straight? No, of course not. Nobody asked the children. You just act on them, you know. Well, they did that. And so he spent a certain amount of months in casts. And he has difficulty standing up for himself.
Wow. Yeah, from that.
Right. Taking a stand, standing on his 2 feet, all those kinds of phrases. During the sessions, I mean, literally with his on his back, with his legs up in the air, when that pain started opening, there'd be a lot of screaming and shaking the legs, screaming, shaking the whole body, screaming, shaking, screaming. Well, of course, that's what should have happened. Screams get trapped in the body because the circumstances around them don't allow them to do it. Does it go away? No, it's still in you.
Right.
All those screams are in you. And it might take you 6 months of screaming just to get through it.
So they lose their voice. They lose everything.
Yes. So he's much more functional and individual, you know, as a result. He's and much, much more able to. He's not as in pain.
And with you as the therapist, I'm sure all of these people are doing, you know, are on the right track in life, Bond, really, because you're very talented and very caring on top of it. Now, there's a lot of therapists that don't have the love, the caring, but I think you have all of that, you know, the love, the caring, the spiritual aspect of the work, you know, the Wilhelm Reich's, you know, foundation, and you combine a lot of different things. So these people that you have been working with, I'm sure that a lot of them are doing just fabulous out there.
Yeah, depending on the trauma, you know, of course, the initial trauma and miseducation and so forth, some of them are functioning where they may have been institutionalized, you know, and some of them, when the trauma was not quite so bad, they're a lot more functional individuals. So, so the way people can reach me is...
Yes, how can we reach you? So we're going to kind of have to close down for today.
Yeah.
But we've been listening, you're listening to Discover Joy's Love. I'm your host, Anita DeFrancesco. My guest today has been Bond Wright, who is a Reichian orgonomy therapist located in Los Angeles. And our theme today was advanced toward pleasure, working, and how that goes hand in hand with mental health. And that is a big topic, mental health, but advance toward pleasure and mental health. Bond, can you please tell us, thank you for coming on this show, where we can reach you? You're doing Zoom work, you're doing sessions in your office in LA. People can come to you if they're from out of state and spend a week and get all this work. So tell us where they can reach you. Website or a phone number or.
Okay. So the program is basically, you know, individual work. They go into my Reichian Therapy Workshop, which is the third Sunday of every month. And that's, and I do have support people that I work with that's appropriate if and when necessary. I could even be, I suggest you go to a class on comedy. You need to laugh. You know? And some people, they, it's not their fault, but they lost the ability to laugh. So I do have support people working with me. And then there is the residential where either locally or out of state or out of country, you can fly in work. So you can reach me at 310-450-3396. 310-450-3396. Or you can go to my website, which is going to be redone pretty soon. I'm looking for a good designer right now. We're looking at a few people. So it's rightbodymind.com. It'll say primarily everything that I just said to you, you know, just brief information and so forth. Or you can also write me. There's you can certainly write me, you know, at my address is Right Body Mind Therapy Center, 11674 Gateway Boulevard, Suite C, West Los Angeles, California, 90064. You can write me a letter and tell me what's going on with you. And that's pretty much it. And we could do part 3, 4, and 5 if you want. You take a topic each time.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about your work right now, Anita. What's going on with your practice?
I'm doing a lot of things. You know, I'm teaching, you know, movement and doing some of the Oregon work as well on groups. I have groups that I teach.
You're actually doing Reikian therapy, right?
Yes, I'm doing the Reikian orgonomy and bioenergetics, but I'm teaching it with the Tantra. So I have Tantra wisdom as my work, and it's I do work for couples and singles, and I have a woman's group, and we're doing like a lot of movement because I do the dance movement work too. You know, that's one of my other talents, and so I'm doing that along with the breathing, because but I'm finding that the combination is great, you know. So I'm doing that, and I wrote all these books. I have about 4 books, and this last book that where you gave me a testimony, I'll get that out to you as soon as I start getting the copies of them. But yeah, I'm just putting books together, and really what I want to do right now is I want to do is give the work away to people that we've learned.
Yeah,
because how much longer, I mean, we're not going to be on the earth forever, but I really feel like this strong need, and maybe COVID, you know, propelled that in some way, to like really give the work away to people so that they can either learn or heal.
Well, thank you very much for your invitation. I really enjoy this.
You're very welcome, Bond, and you've been listening to Discover Joyous Love. You can find me at discoverjoyouslove.com, and tune in for this podcast that'll be up soon. Thank you.